It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. They describe themselves as a grassroots group elevating the voices of the Hispanic community, and they're active again in Wisconsin. We discuss priorities with the Libre Initiative, and you can call in to ask a question or share insights along the way. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ramon Candelaria is State Strategic Director of the Wisconsin Chapter of the Libre Initiative. Ramon, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Oh, thank you so much for having us and having me.
Yes.
On today.
So start out personally. What are your motivations to get involved in the Libre Initiative and lead its work in Wisconsin?
Well, you know, it's a nonprofit, nonpartisan a movement that advances the principles to support economic freedom for Latinos, not only in the state, but throughout the country. And, you know, really focusing on removing barriers that keep Latinos from achieving the American dream. I mean, we want all people to succeed. Everyone deserves to be prosperous. And there's a strong emphasis on redistributing knowledge and opportunity and not so much wealth. But we know that if we do that well, people can live their best, healthy, successful life. And so we know the impact that Latinos have in this state and in the country, and we're excited to be a part of that movement forward.
Yeah, Latino voters, there are a large group of swing voters in our nation. Does that raise the stakes for the Libre Initiative to engage Latino voters and convey your organization's values in these, you know, as this is such an important force in politics in the country?
Absolutely. I think Latinos have made and played a role and made a huge impact in not just voting, but, you know, creating wealth and advancing this country's movement forward. And so we know that there's a growing population here in Wisconsin that are going to play a major role in supporting the movement forward with elected officials and voting, and you know, not just here but throughout the country.
Can you go into the free market ideas that the Libre Initiative is advocating for? I mean, we know that the Libre Initiative is affiliated with Charles Koch's network, Americans for Prosperity, the mega donor. Can you go into those free market ideas for us?
Well, we're funded by a number, hundreds of donors, and they are certainly a part of it. And it's a group of people that just, again, love freedom, love supporting the advancement of achieving that American dream. And you know, it's more about that than any specific area.
What are Hispanic people in Wisconsin gaining from the Libre Initiative since the state chapter started?
Well, you know, we're all about removing barriers that keep them from achieving those dreams and keep them from achieving and getting support in around immigration, healthcare, education, and areas such as those.
We're talking about the political group, the Libre Initiative. We have Ramon Candelaria, Wisconsin's new strategic director. You can join in with your questions. You can share your perspectives at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ramon, last week, President Joe Biden announced he would expand the wall delineating the border between the United States and Mexico. And the wall was funded during President Trump's administration. And then during President Biden's 2020 campaign, he vowed he would stop the border wall's construction. What do you make of this development?
Well, you know, that's, you know, I can probably direct you to some folks at the leadership level here at Libre, but we're all about securing borders and making sure that there is some security in borders, and, you know, we truly believe in making sure that the rights and of people are respected. And maybe it's best if I could, you know.
Well, yeah, and let's look at that a little bit further. Yeah, because
yeah.
The Libre Initiative has talked about investments for border infrastructure, for border technology, and, you know, creating better programs for for entry into the United States and for processing. So what does the Libre Initiative propose to build a secure and humane southern border? What are you advocating for?
Well, our first priority are about, you know, the Dreamers, making sure that they have access to staying in this country. I think it's very important that we keep the family structure together. That's important for us in Libre. We believe that, you know, immigrants have played a huge role in creating wealth and opportunity in this country, and we want to keep moving that forward. We respect the laws and we respect the Constitution and keeping borders secure and making sure that there's, the personnel and the infrastructure and technology, the wellness programs, you know, for folks once they come in. And, we believe that, you know, again, this is immigrants have played a huge role in keeping this country moving forward. And we want to continue that with respect of the law and the process that the Constitution in this country allows for.
I want to bring this question close to home here on immigration. Wisconsin state laws limit issuing driver's licenses to U.S. citizens. And then in August, ProPublica reported how immigrants who work on dairy farms are isolated and stuck on the farms where they work and they often live. What is your stance on issuing driver's licenses to non-citizens?
That's not a question that I'm prepared to answer for Libre.
Mm-hmm.
Again, maybe I can connect you with somebody in the leadership there, talk, you know, deeper about that.
Do you find that the Libre initiative provides services to immigrants in Wisconsin, who cross the border into the U.S. without travel documents?
Can you repeat that question again? I'm sorry.
Does the Libre Initiative provide services and support to immigrants in Wisconsin, and especially for those who cross the border into this country without the proper documents?
Well, I'm 3 weeks into the position. We're really establishing some of the things that are going to be working best here for Wisconsin. I do know that having a driver's license and having the proper documentation and being prepared once you're here is very important to us. And in certain states, you know, making sure that folks have that is part of the process that we've, you know, been engaged with.
Let's take a call now. Jim is joining us from Juneau. Jim, hi, what is your question?
Hello, thank you for taking my call. Well, a little back history here. I'm a 60-year-old construction worker. I've been in the trades all my life, even as a kid with my grandfather's business. Now, I'm from the East Coast, and I will be very clear here. There was, in the beginning, what I saw as a prejudice towards Mexican workers back there. So now, I've always been a fair and looked for an equal, you know, treat everybody the same. That way you can be treated the same. So my question is, is this organization fighting to try and get equal pay for their workers? Because that's where, having asked the questions that myself all these years, have found that a lot of the anger has come, is by marketing themselves, drastically undercutting what the pay is for the services that are being provided,
Jim,
and therefore cutting the throats of the workers that have been at this all their life.
Jim, thanks for the question. Ramon, go ahead on equal pay.
I mean, we're about, you know, having equal opportunity and equal knowledge. You know, I appreciate the comments and from this gentleman. Another point I want to kind of bring up is that, you know, the Latino population, and people usually generalize and kind of put it into strictly the Mexican community, but the Latino population is very diverse around Puerto Rican, Mexican, Dominican, Cuban, and others. So, you know, I really want to make sure that folks are aware that, you know, that there's that diversity there. And again, it's about equal opportunity and equal and redistributing knowledge and giving folks the opportunity to truly live that American dream and be prosperous in any situation that they find themselves in here in the United States.
Ramon Candelaria with us, State Strategic Director of the Libre Initiative, a group focused on how economic, educational, healthcare, immigration issues all affect Hispanic and Latino people nationwide and here in Wisconsin. You can call in with a question. You can bring your views, your insights to the discussion at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The group, the Libre Initiative, is restarted here in Wisconsin, seeking to mobilize our state's Hispanic community around pressing issues as we see the 2024 election cycle gearing up. And you can be part of the conversation, calling in with a question, sharing your thoughts at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Ramon Candelaria is State Strategic Director of the Libre Initiative in Wisconsin. And Ramon, what are your plans for connecting with Hispanic and Latino people in Wisconsin?
You know, working really close with our partners is always important. Trusting those folks at a ground level that are connecting with everyday folks, whether it's through the churches, whether it's through other nonprofits, partners like Americans for Prosperity and other groups are really coming out strong and working together to really get the information we need from those folks that really need the service that we're about to provide and continue to provide for them. So there's a combination of media and there's a combination of grassroots engagements. We're going to have a few grassroots engagement directors out there mobilizing folks throughout the state and really looking for those folks that want to be heard and want to be a part of the process.
Do you find that you have ready and willing partners and collaborators in this work when you talk about churches and other nonprofits?
Absolutely. I think it's overwhelming, the amount of support. People are starting to feel like it's an important time to really be engaged in politics, engaged in economic issues, engaged in how the sections of their life are impacted by some of the things that are happening right now. And I think there's a big group of folks that have been kind of promised things that aren't coming to life. You know, folks are struggling out there and looking for a way to be there for themselves. You know, that we're seeing and hearing that a lot of people, you know, aren't interested in a certain handout. They're interested in being a part of growing themselves, aligning with folks that have what they need to really become, you know, live that American dream and be prosperous and get information around healthcare that makes sense for them, get information around immigration issues that make sense for their family. And small businesses are really stepping to the plate and engaging with us. And we love that. I think that's the heart of who we are, you know, making sure that folks have what they need to be successful for themselves, by themselves.
In your initial weeks here on the ground, what has been the message of small businesses that you've talked to? What did they tell you?
You know, we're hearing that, you know, it's the cost that they're having to put out to be successful is overwhelming them. I mean, they're having to, let's take a small restaurant, for example. I've heard from a couple small business owners that they're cooking, they're cleaning, they're doing it all because they can't afford to bring on the team that they need to expand. And when you think of minimum wage and all of that, important for some, but you know, if you double the cost of hiring folks and they can't afford it, then they're stuck. And so, you know, there needs to be some support there then. And economically, they're staying open, but it's becoming more and more tough for them to do so. And we're hearing a lot about that. And we're hearing, there's a lot of promises around grants and opportunities, but it's not reaching the majority of small business owners in certain neighborhoods, specifically Latino ones.
Turning to education here, your organization considers education one of its primary issues. How can Wisconsin schools better serve Hispanic and Latino families?
Well, we believe that, when parents and children are engaged in their education and have a choice to where they're going, it is very important. I think, we believe that customizing educational plan and having educational freedom is extremely important. I look at myself, for example, I'm a product of public schools, but it wasn't until I was able to, get to the university level and have a say-so on where I go and how my education, based on my strengths and based on the things that I've been through in life, had helped me, move forward. I went from graduating last in my class to, getting a scholarship at Harvard to attend some courses. And so, I myself am a product of that. And I see the impact of being able to control the type of education I have, who I get educated by, and what's important to me as a person searching to be successful in not just academically, but professionally. And so I think that, that's important.
Ramon Candelaria is State Strategic Director of the political group The Libre Initiative, now active in Wisconsin as we look at its pressing issues. And you can join in the conversation with your questions and your thoughts. The number is 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Ramon, what obstacles exist for undocumented students, also called Dreamers, who want to attend college in Wisconsin?
Well, everybody's obstacles are different, but I think, the biggest is the opportunity to live free and to be here and not be worried about being deported and not have those political worries and always watching one day you're in a good position, the next day you're not. And a lot of all of them have come based on not having their own decision about being here. And so we need to support them. We need to make sure that they can have that legal right, that freedom to stay here and pursue their, their American dream, or pursue their academic dreams and everything else. And we know that they make huge contributions to this country. And so we're in support of Dreamers.
Would a solution to the issues that Dreamers face, could that encourage more people to come to this country illegally? How does the Libre Initiative balance that issue?
I would personally, say that I don't think it encourages that. When we do it right and people follow the facts and people follow the economic impact that has and the contributions that has, I don't think so. I think, if we create a process that makes it easier for folks that legitimately deserve to be here, we're not talking about those that, come here and aren't following the rule of law and coming in illegally. We're talking about folks that are here already that have had no decision on being here and doing the right thing and continuing to contribute to this country and to this state.
The Libre Initiative recently ran ads on Spanish language TV station Univision against Bidenomics. Which Biden economic policies does your group oppose?
That question's a little too deep for me right now at this point. But we know that I can tell you that folks are talking about when they go to the grocery store, they're putting food back. When they're looking at their monthly statements, they got to make a decision between paying rent and gas. We see that folks are struggling more than ever right now. At least the folks we're engaging with, the Latinos we're talking to, the small businesses that are a part of this. And so something is not working for them. And everyday folks, I mean, you're seeing it everywhere, not just on one side of the aisle, but, you know, both all people, you know, that you know, the middle class and lower income, you know, are feeling that pain. And those weren't the promises that most of us heard.
Ramon, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. Thank you so much. It's truly a pleasure. And we encourage folks to visit our website and, you know, get engaged. And we're happy to meet with anyone that would love to speak to us or learn more about Libre.
Ramon Candelaria, State Strategic Director of the Libre Initiative. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The American manufacturing giant 3M, the inventor of Post-it notes, it operates four plants in Wisconsin communities. A piece in the Wall Street Journal digs into 3M's challenges to create new products and the effects of phasing out PFAS chemicals in its manufacturing processes. You can be part of the discussion. Call in with a question. Bring your comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. John Kyleman covers U.S. manufacturing for the Wall Street Journal's Chicago Bureau. John, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Yes, 3M, a $34 billion company, locations around the globe, including four here in Wisconsin. And you write 3M is in a dry spell. How so?
3M is a company that relies on a very broad array of products to make money, anything from sandpaper to N95 masks to air filters to all sorts of adhesives to Post-it notes, command strips, you name it, 55,000, more than 55,000 different products. But they are in a continual race against not only their competitors, but sort of technological changes. And as their products become, if competitors catch up, as their products become more commoditized, they always have to come up with something new. And according to some investors and people who work at the company or who recently left the company, they are falling behind in that race.
So their products have to evolve. They have to create new ones at the same time. And that creates a lot of stress inside a company. You talked with, I think at the end of the piece, a retired scientist who told you 3M has all the resources they need to, I think the words were, to fight their way out of it. Can you explain that more, that sentiment? You know, what is it like inside 3M?
3M is going through a tough time. There's no doubt about it. And it's not solely because of sort of business challenges. There is a large overhanging shadow on the company that actually comes from one of their all-time most important innovations. And that was a group of chemicals commonly known as PFAS or forever chemicals that it helped develop back in the 1940s. And they are chemicals that go into all sorts of products, including anything from dental floss and pizza boxes to foam that's meant to put out fires. And sort of the key characteristic of these chemicals is that they are very heat resistant, very stain and water resistant. So they're good in waterproofing materials, or, you know, in the case of the foam, smothering fires. However, they're called forever chemicals for a reason, and that is because the bonds that are created between the fluorine and carbon molecules, or atoms, I'm sorry, are so strong that they basically don't degrade. And so once they're out in nature, they stay there forever. And there is a great deal of concern that these can cause health effects. And so they, 3M and other companies that make these chemicals and these firefighting foams in particular, are being sued for billions and billions of dollars. And 3M, in fact, has already settled some of that litigation for up to a cost, what's going to cost them up to $12.5 billion. But there's much more to go.
In fact, this summer, 3M agreed to pay $10.3 billion to American cities and towns, including Wisconsin, over contaminated drinking water with toxic PFAS. What is 3M's role in that litigation, in PFAS pollution, and how it affects their products now?
Well, they are being sued for the chemicals that they produced and for the firefighting foam that they produced. The heart of this current litigation is, these firefighting foams were used all over, and once they, spray down a fire or even train with them, they would get into the soil or the groundwater and ultimately work their way into a drinking water plant. And to get them out of the water, it costs a great deal of money. Basically, I mean, the thing that's most commonly used are giant charcoal filters, almost like a king size version of a Brita filter that people have in their houses. But that's expensive. And so they were sued by, oh, I can't remember exactly how many, several hundred municipal water producers, saying, "Hey, your chemicals are in our plant and are in our water, and you need to pay to help us get them out." And so that's what the lawsuit that settled over the summer was all about. But there's still litigation hanging out there from state attorney generals and a lot of people who say that they suffered ill health effects because of PFAS. So that's what they still have to deal with.
What I wonder, and I'm sure, the courts will grapple with it as well, that did 3M know, did they know that this class of chemicals that they helped develop, as you said, in the 1940s, did they know they were dangerous when they put them in their products?
That is certainly being alleged by the people who are suing them. 3M, I should say. It is 3M's position that that these chemicals can be made and used safely.
Well, is there a liability in their customers who bought their products and then perhaps used them in the wrong way or not following, 3M's manufacturer's directions? I mean, so that too is, I think, is a tension.
Well, another aspect of this is not just the firefighting foams, but the another, part of the litigation is, when products containing PFAS or the chemicals themselves are disposed of in landfills, that can create, when it rains, they call it leachate, that can escape the landfill and get into groundwater and is another potential source of contamination.
We're talking about the global corporation 3M, the challenges ahead. We have Wall Street Journal reporter John Kileman recently profiled the company. You can join in the conversation, calling in with your questions and comments, 800-642-1234. John, as of last year, 3M had more than 90,000 employees and at least hundreds here in Wisconsin. Is 3M in danger of closing any operations?
3M has, I think this year, announced 8,500 layoffs, and that goes with several other rounds of layoffs that have happened in recent years. They have not, as far as I know, announced any plans to shut down particular facilities, but that certainly is a danger when business conditions deteriorate.
I would imagine as well as when they wind down PFAS manufacturing, that too would impact your employee roles who are, the scientists no longer making those chemicals.
It could. They have said that PFAS accounts for, I think, 1.3 billion out of their roughly $34 billion in revenue. So it's not an enormous portion, but it's not nothing either. The chemicals are primarily made in, I believe, in three plants in the US, in Minnesota, Illinois, and Alabama. I do not believe they are made in Wisconsin. And in fact, the Wisconsin litigation that was brought by your state's attorney general is mostly focusing on firefighting foam, as is true with most of the other states as well.
What are you watching for most as this litigation unfolds against 3M?
Well, the financial impact is probably the most important, at least as far as their operations go. They now have billions of dollars that they have to pay, and next year they are going to be spinning off the healthcare unit of 3M into its own company, and that unit accounts for about one quarter of their revenues. So there's going to be less money coming in. There's going to be these PFAS settlement payments that they're going to have to make, and more to come, undoubtedly. And on top of that, they also have, a dividend that they pay to shareholders. Basically, if you own a share of one share of 3M, you get $6 a year, in payment to you. And that's something that they've always increased that dividend every year for 60 some years. So that's another big piece of the financial puzzle that they're going to have to manage, because people count on that dividend. So there's going to be a lot of pressure to maintain it, while at the same time less money's coming in and more money's going out for these legal settlement payments.
John Kilman with us, reporter at the Wall Street Journal's Chicago Bureau covering American manufacturing. A recent look inside 3M. You can be part of the discussion, calling in with a question, sharing your thoughts. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The future of 3M innovation and the fallout over PFAS chemicals, these are aspects of a Wall Street Journal piece about 3M's headwinds. The manufacturing giant operates four Wisconsin plants, and John Kilman covers U.S. manufacturing for the Wall Street Journal's Chicago Bureau. You can join the discussion at any point, calling in with a question, sharing what's on your mind. 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. John, you write about the changing culture and innovation strategy at 3M. How is 3M's innovation strategy different today than when the company was founded more than a century ago?
Well, it has long been their practice to try to introduce a lot of new products, believing that you don't really know what's going to take off until you put it in the marketplace. And that has changed, where they now are trying to be more selective on the front end and taking fewer shots, introducing fewer products, believing that they've sort of marshaled their resources, to get the best chance of success in what they put out there. And some longtime 3M employees say that's not the way to do it, and that it's not working, that you need to, you don't really know what's going to succeed unless you put it out there. And basically, if you take fewer swings at the plate, you're going to get fewer home runs. And the company certainly doesn't agree with that, but that's kind of the heart of the internal tension right now.
So they kind of say, well, look, we're going for quality versus quantity, but there's that competing tension of saying, like, you know, put it all out there and then see what sticks in the marketplace.
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, but what you know, the old timers expressed to me is that you know, you can think that you are you know, taking quality attempts, but you're just fooling yourself if you think you can outsmart the market.
William McKnight was an early president of the company. What was McKnight's influence?
Enormous. He joined the company in 1907, I think, about 5 years after it got started, and, you know, rose to the very top. And what distinguished him was, you know, at a time when workers really were seen as sort of interchangeable cogs that are just supposed to do exactly what they're told to do. He believed in initiative and in people, you know, being given the freedom to pursue their own ideas in service of the company. And one thing that came out of that is still in effect today is what they call 15% time, where you are, you know, a researcher is entitled to using 15% of their time to do a project that may have nothing to do with sort of their normal duties. And many, many profitable and important things have come out of that.
I wonder, is that 15% time still valid today? Does that still work today?
It is nominally valid. they say it's valid. The company does. I have heard from people inside the company that it may be a little more difficult to do now than in years past. But at least officially, 15% time is still in effect.
Still alive. You know, you report on other global companies, even Harley Davidson. Are other giant companies experiencing similar dry spells like 3M?
You know, 3M is very unique. It's because they make so many different things and such a broad array of things that I think, I mean, that's always been sort of a challenge for them to kind of explain themselves, you know, particularly to investors. And, you know, for a time, the numbers sort of explained themselves because they were so good. The growth was very robust and the profit margins were so strong. But when that starts to drop or the growth is not as strong as it has once been, then they come under more pressure to, you know, here's what we are, here's what we're doing, here's where we're going. And if you look at the share price, which is very depressed now, the message that they are transmitting doesn't seem to be, you know, coming through very strong.
You write about 3M's new innovations that are in the works. And what is 3M's research into electric vehicle technology?
Yeah, this is something that would seem to suit them very well. I mean, they are at their heart a materials company, and they are doing a lot of work into, for example, materials that will help electric vehicle batteries work more efficiently. And that is, you know, anytime they have a call with investors or speaking at a conference or something like that, that's the one area that they always point to. That last year, it grew 30% to hit $500 million in sales. In the overall picture, that's still pretty small, but I mean, they could point to that as an area of a very substantial growth. But that is also an area that, you know, practically every company under the sun is looking at electric vehicles to get a boost.
That's what I was wondering. I mean, are they entering markets that are congested with a lot of competition for these products?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, electric vehicles are, you know, I cover quite a few companies, and just about all of them point to that as an area for where they're pinning their hopes, because it's it's, new and there's so much money behind it. They all sort of forecast a lot of growth that's going to come from that sector, and 3M is no different. And I guess we will see if they're able to maintain that type of growth rate, or if competitors are going to start to nibble away at what they have.
We're talking about the global corporation 3M, its innovations that are coming, and the headwinds it faces. Wall Street Journal reporter John Kileman covers the company and others, manufacturing giants. You can join in the conversation. Your questions are welcome at 800-642-1234. John, we started the conversation about the litigation troubles. And this summer, 3M settled a lawsuit with American military veterans and service members who say they suffered hearing loss from using the company's earplugs. Can you explain what's going on in this lawsuit?
Sure. That was entirely separate from their PFAS litigation. The 3M bought a company, I think, in the 2000s that made these earplugs, and what was special about them was that they were supposed to filter out, really loud noise like explosions and things like that, while still allowing you to hear, someone speaking close by. And the allegation was that they did not work properly, and that people, veterans, suffered hearing damage because of that. 3M disputed that, of course. And they ultimately ended up settling the case on for $6 billion, which was a little better than some analysts expected. And so you saw the stock price climb after that, but now it has sunk again and then some.
So do you find that there was strain from that lawsuit put on the business?
Well, it's going to be a financial strain because they're going to have to pay that off over the coming years. And I think anytime you have as much litigation as 3M has been facing, that is a distraction for the top people at the company. Instead of thinking about, how can we, outcompete our peers in electric vehicles, for example, or how can we come out with a new product that nobody has ever seen before? So much of their time is spent dealing with this litigation. It's not spent on how to further their business.
John, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
John Kileman covers U.S. manufacturing for the Wall Street Journal's Chicago Bureau. His article is titled "The Long Dry Spell at One of America's Most Innovative Companies." I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.